from WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
All right, let's start with a call. Remember that you too can be a caller on The Sporkful. Drop me a line at dan@sporkful.com or give me a call, 908-9-SPORK-9. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who's this?
Hi, my name is Maggie. I'm 11 years old, and I'm calling from Fort Worth, Texas.
Hey, Maggie. Am I correct that you are one of the presidents of the Junior Eaters Society?
Yes, I am.
Well, that's excellent. Well, welcome to The Sporkful, Madam President. So what would you like to talk about?
I was going to talk about burritos. Like, for stuff you put inside of the burritos, I like beans, cheese, and lettuce, and occasionally tomatoes or other vegetables. I rarely put salsa or hot sauce in between it because the spiciness really masks the flavor for me. I also like to put some sour cream on it, but I always go for the minimum because that could also mask the flavor.
Well, you keep talking about masking the flavor, which is a very valid concern, and I'm glad to hear you raising that. What flavors are you worried about masking?
The beans and the cheese.
Mm.
I have a big problem with people masking the cheese. They just put so many beans in it, and then they put, like, a tablespoon of cheese. And then they can call it a bean and cheese burrito.
Maggie, can I have your permission to make t-shirts that say, I have a big problem with people masking the cheese?
Yes, you can.
I'll give you one for free once I get them made, okay?
Okay, cool.
All right. That's going to be my new favorite thing to say to everyone all the time. So now let me ask you about your sour cream application technique. How do you like to get the sour cream? Do you put it inside the burrito?
I put a little bit on the inside and a little bit on the outside.
I'm not a huge sour cream fan in general, but I'll put that aside because that's just my personal taste. I get worried that sour cream makes the tortilla a little mushy. Is that a concern for you?
Sometimes it does, but if you eat it fast, it normally doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, because I would propose to you another alternative is to keep the sour cream on the side, and then you take the knife and just spread a little bit right into that the opening of the burrito where you're about to bite. That way it's preserving the tortilla structural integrity.
I can actually think that that's a good idea.
What do you think about flour versus corn tortilla?
Flour versus corn tortilla. I have a big problem with them asking me flour or corn on my burrito. You know, if I wanted a corn tortilla on it, I would have ordered a taquito or however you say it. Taquito.
You're totally right. I mean, look, Maggie, I think flour tortillas are much better than corn tortillas almost all the time.
Yeah. Unless it's in a taco, I'm not a fan of corn tortillas.
So you like corn tortillas when they're crunchy?
Yeah.
I think you're right. And I'm glad to hear that that we're on the same page with that, Maggie. Well, Maggie, down there in Texas, Madam President of the Sporkful Junior Eater Society, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely. And because if history has taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Great show lined up for you today. So excited to have Peter Sagal on The Sporkful. Quick note before we get to that, especially if you're a newcomer to The Sporkful, please do check out Sporkful.com. Connect with us on social media, all that at Sporkful.com. Okay, let's go ahead now and jump into today's topic for mastication and rumination, which is Peter Sagal, The Sporkful Interview. Well, friends, like many of you, I've been a fan of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for many years and a fan of Peter Sagal's work. So it was super exciting for me to get a chance to sit down with him in Chicago at WBEZ in the very studio where Wait, Wait first began many years ago. So let's go to the tape. Joining me now is the esteemed host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's also an award-winning playwright, screenwriter, and author, Peter Sagal. Welcome to The Sporkful.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's great to be in The Sporkful Dome.
Yes.
I expected the food would be better.
Yeah, or existent.
I just thought, I mean, all you've got is like tubs of goldfish. I find this disappointing.
Yeah, my two-year-old daughter's in charge of the food.
There so. You are. Craft services, ladies and gentlemen.
So we're here at WBEZ in Chicago in Studio 3, and I knew that Wait, Wait was not a live audience show at its inception, but
right.
I did not realize that it was a studio show for as long as it was.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, considering how much of a good idea it was to do it in front of a live audience, how long we avoided that obvious wisdom and did it in the studio. And since radio doesn't yet have visual images, I can tell you it's a pretty big room. And I used to sit in it by myself behind this counter where we were both sitting now and look through that large window at my producers who would stare at me sort of blankly as we tried to tape the show with panelists and Carl who were in other cities connected in their own studios. It's as close as I ever want to come to the feeling of being executed. Just sitting by myself in a very large room while people stare at me, not pleased with what I've done.
I'd like to start with a few totally random questions that all food related, and then we'll work our way into food and eating.
Sort of like a little amuse-bouche.
That's right. That's right. We'll get warmed up. I think it's interesting that you've written for stage, screen, radio, and the page.
Yes.
And with Wait, Wait, you're writing for a live audience and a radio audience simultaneously.
This is true.
Which I think is a lot harder than people realize and harder than you make it seem. I'm curious, what do you see as the main differences between these different formats from a writer's perspective?
It's tricky. I mean, well, first you're writing for the spoken word, which, I mean, there are some things that are just brilliant on the page that are very hard to say out loud, that is, and get any impact. Our show is supposed to feel like an improvisational show. So again, you're supposed to write stuff that sounds like you're talking. This is where my playwright background helps, because I'm basically writing dialogue for myself. And by the way, I should say right here that I'm flattered that you give me credit, but the show is actually written by myself along with Ian Chillog, Mike Danforth, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton, as well as the panelists who contribute what they do. So when I say I'm just hogging all the credit for a lot of talented people. Just be aware of that.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, in addition to sort of writing conversationally, is you do in fact have to address that issue of the live audience versus the radio audience. When there are, say, 500 people in front of you, as there are in our home theater, it is really tempting to give them all your attention. It is really tempting to do anything you can to please those people and make them like you, because there they are. And if they don't like you, it would make you feel bad. But if you work too hard to please them in front of you, you will start to alienate and leave out all the, well, in our case, 3.5 million people who are listening to us on the radio. We never do like byplay with the audience. You have people calling in. So there's a representative of the listening audience who's out there. So it could be you.
Right, right. And when you transition to write for the page, is that a difficult transition? Because every week you guys are making shows. Tell me about that transition.
Well, I mean, the greatest advantage of there's a very obscure movie called The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother. Okay. Gene Wilder wrote and starred in the mid-70s, and it's a Sherlock Holmes parody, obviously. And the villain, who I think is Moriarty, it's been a long time, it might be Moriarty's brother, he says that the reason he's a villain, he's got this psychological compulsion, he has to do something rotten every 4 minutes, otherwise he'll go insane. And I often think of that because when you're writing our show, you have to get to a joke every 10 seconds. The greatest thing I love in writing for other things, like the book I'm working on now or the book I wrote before, the magazine articles I write, is not having to tell a joke every 10 seconds. I like to tell a joke, but I can work my way up to it. I can take a paragraph off from being funny. I can take a whole article off from being funny. And it's a great release. I feel like I'm released from my horrible psychological compulsion.
So you've written some great pieces for Runner's World, some of which talk about growing up as a fat kid and how it drove you to get into running.
Yes.
I was a chubby kid, too. I wore husky pants, just like you.
Those corduroys especially are awful.
And, and even the husky label was written like in fat letters.
Oh, to be brought over there? Right. Oh, the shame.
You're an avid runner, and you're obviously more fit than I am. I love a good, long, brisk walk. But I still can't deal with running. Like when I'm walking, I can listen to music. I can get lost in thought. I'll walk for miles. But when I'm running, all I can think about is the fact that I'm running.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to let you know about is your producer and my friend, Ian Chillog. He's also an avid runner, as you probably know. And Ian did a study where he went out for different runs, listened to different podcasts.
Yes.
And checked his times.
Yeah.
And he cataloged his time per mile.
I did not know this. What did he find?
While listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, 7.5 minutes per mile, 7:30. While listening to The Dinner Party, 7:25.
Yeah.
This American Life, 7:15.
Oh.
And The Sporkful, 6:55.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Is there a causation here?
It may be that I talk faster. It may just be that there's a faster pace with a Sporkful than with, like, you know, This American Life has this sort of that sort of classic melodramatic brooding moments of music that are not exactly the get up and go.
But wouldn't the best podcast for running just be somebody yelling, "They're right behind you," over and over again?
Right, right. The other part of the Sporkful, and this, you know, segues us towards the direction of food.
Yes,
is that we talk about food all the time. People always say that it makes you hungry listening to the Sporkful.
So you want
to
get home,
exactly,
get something to eat.
Well, and a person who runs 20 miles burns about 2,000 calories,
about
which
that?
Is the recommended intake for an average adult for an entire day.
Right.
So, like, when you run 20 miles, I mean, you've got some serious calories to spend.
It is fun.
So, I mean, what do you like to when you when you're going to go a little crazy, what do you like to spend it on?
See, here's the problem, is that I wish that I was better about that. I wish that I would say to myself, oh, I've just earned 2,000 calories, therefore I shall spend those calories or ingest those calories in a particularly useful and delicious and even healthful way. And instead, while I'm done thinking about what I might eat, I look down and my hand is in an empty Fritos bag. It's like, oh. But what I do is I say to myself, like, oh, I did eat that donut. And I'm the kind of guy who does what I like to call a plausibly deniable segmentation.
Okay.
You know what that is? It's like there's a plate of donuts and you reach out and you take off one quarter of one donut and you eat it. And about 5 minutes later, you take off another quarter and you eat it. And another quarter and you eat it. And the fourth and final quarter and you eat it.
It's like it doesn't count as a whole donut.
It doesn't count because you didn't eat a donut. You had 4 quarters of a donut.
Right. Now, because you're closely identified with Chicago, I'd be remiss if I did not ask you about some classic Chicago foods.
Okay.
Especially as they relate to some classic New York foods.
Because
you and I both grew up in New Jersey, the New York suburbs. I lived in Chicago. You are strongly associated with Chicago. the guy from Wait, Wait.
Hey, Chicago is a welcoming place. My joke is they'll claim you as a native if you have a long layover at O'Hare.
Totally.
I'm into it.
I mean, I love Chicago.
It's the best.
I miss it here terribly. Now, Chicago deep dish pizza.
Hate it.
Really?
Yes.
Now, see, I have been asked for years to take a position on Chicago versus New York pizza.
Right.
And my position is they're both great in their own way, and that to put them up against each other is a false choice, that they're two different foods that use similar ingredients.
Well, the Chicago pizza, deep dish pizza, is not pizza. It is, in the immortal words of the cartoonist Reuben Bowling, author of Tom the Dancing Bug, it is a lasagna-based bread food. And now look, if you like it, that's fine. I'm not crazy about it. It's like pie crust, 2 inches of cheese, some tomato sauce, maybe some meats if you want it. And it's incredibly dense and incredibly thick and rich. I mean, you hard to eat more than one piece. And that's fine if you want to eat a pound of cheese and some pie crust. But that's not pizza. I mean, to me, New York pizza is great. Flat pizza is fine. I've yet to find a really great Chicago pizzeria, although I'm a fan of pizza. My favorite pizza is New Haven pizza, which is awfully good. And that style of pizza, that crispy crust in the really hot wood oven without too much toppings, just enough, is I think, pretty much my favorite.
Interesting. I'll be honest. I have not had New Haven pizza.
You what?
I know. It's horrible. But I had a Sporkful listener. The first time I mentioned on the air, a listener donated money to finance a trip to New Haven.
Are you going
to
go?
I'm going to go in the next few months.
There's the Sal's versus Pepe's question. Both are great. It's all about the crust. Everybody thinks, oh, it's all about the toppings. It's not about the toppings.
No,
it's
not
about
at all. Right. No. And here's a quick pizza question.
Yes.
Of the three basic ingredients of pizza, cheese, crust, sauce, which do you think is the most important to determining the quality of
crust,
the pizza?
Crust, no question.
Really?
And I say this as a guy who has made his own pizza at home and has really struggled with the quality of the crust. Because there's so many variables. Well, first of all, you want some flavor. It's just a cracker. It's no good. So you want it to be a little doughy. A little olive oil is nice. You definitely want a nice bready. Like, it should taste like really good bread, the kind of bread that you eat without butter because it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, it's got to have texture. And finding that right balance between too crispy and too doughy is hard. You and I grew up in the same place. We probably ate the same kind of pizza where you pick it up and it immediately flops.
Yeah.
So you end up folding it so as to try to bring some structural integrity to the pizza wedge. Yeah, pizza what people are used to, and that's fine. But I think a crispier pizza is better, in my view.
So when you have that ideal pizza, do you still fold?
Well, if you have that ideal pizza, well, one thing, when you're making it at home, you're making smaller pizzas. But if you have that ideal pizza, you don't have to. It should have enough structural integrity that certainly one hand and a finger at the front should be enough to get it to your mouth.
Oh, you do like a cantilever.
The cantilever, you sort of pick up the back, you're holding the crust. I'm miming this now, it's radio. And you have your middle finger or 2 fingers on the other hand, just holding the just for the first couple of bites. I think that's the right level of structural integrity. If it doesn't flop a little, then it's probably too crispy and you're going to crunch it and you're not going to feel good about it. But One thing you may remember from Chicago is one weird thing about Chicago is you get a flat pizza, which you might call New York pizza, whatever, regular pizza, and they cut it in a grid.
Right.
Which is weird.
Very weird.
And it means you get pieces of very odd shapes. You get pieces that have no crust, pieces that are mostly crust because they're just cut off the edge. And I have grown, as shocking as this was the first time I got it, I have grown to like it because it's easier to adjust your pizza consumption. If you think about it, if you give it like 8 wedges, right, you're just really reduced to that unit of pizza. With smaller variable pieces, you could eat any number of like square pizza inches,
right,
covering the surface. You can sort of arrange those variously odd-sized pizzas and therefore eat just the amount of pizza you want, which I'm all for.
Well, that is interesting, though, because I question in general. I think that when you serve something in very small pieces, yeah, any kind of food, when you cut it up into smaller pieces, people are more likely to take. You know, if you're on the fence,
yeah,
you want more pizza, you're not going to you might end up take a whole other slice, but you'll take one more little square. But then 10 minutes later, you'll take one more little square.
I completely concede that point, and it's easy to imagine somebody who's saying, well, I'm a little hungry, but I've had 3 slices. I'm certainly going to take another large slice. And that's true. However, that's counteracted by the fact that let's say you really aren't that hungry, but you've taken 2 slices. Now you've taken a third. You've had 3 or 4 bites. And you're like, that's enough pizza for me. Who in the world can then put the pizza down, that third slice, less than half eaten, and walk away? I cannot.
That's true. I do need to take issue with your statement regarding the superior importance of the crust. I agree that crust is crucial. I think cheese is probably the least important because I'm not saying any of them are not important.
Yeah.
But I think that in terms of what determines the quality, I think that there's a lot of pretty good cheese out there. I get what you're saying. If you're trying to get the perfect crust, that's extraordinarily hard. But yeah. I feel like it's not that hard to get pretty good crust.
What you're working up to is a sauce guy. You're a sauce guy.
I feel like the sauce, when I have great pizza, when I look at the extremes in my pizza eating experiences,
yeah,
the best pizzas I've ever had and the most disgusting pizzas, the issue was always the sauce. That was the determining factor.
Right.
When I ate a pizza from the souvenir stand at Bryce Canyon in Utah, and it was the worst pizza I've ever had in my life.
I could have predicted that.
Yeah, it was wrong,
yes,
for many reasons, but the sauce was the biggest problem. I have a series of questions that are sort of my own adapted version of the Proust questionnaire that James Lipton uses.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I tweaked them all to be about food.
I think you as well, you should.
Yes, and I want to ask you some of these questions now,
please,
if I may.
By all means.
Here we go. You ready for the questions?
Ready for the questions.
What dish do you cook best?
I have become, in the classic suburban dad model, a fine griller of burgers. And it's a simple thing, but I specialize in things that are seemingly more difficult than they really are.
How thick do you make the patties?
The patties should be around an inch thick because the greatest the reason that my burgers, people like them so much, A, the meat is loosely packed.
Crucial. That's
crucial. What you're experiencing in eating burgers is more texture than flavor than you're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And with those pre-processed things, the meat is dense and chewy. It's what people expect. So when they get something that's not, they're amazed. Secondly, you want it thick enough so that you can nicely cook the outside while leaving the inside a little pink. I like mine's a little redder in the inside, but pink is on the inside. One of the reasons I don't like Five Guys, they overcook everything.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's a food safety thing.
Right.
Hell with food safety. You want to pink in the inside. And here's the most important thing, and nobody understands this. Do not touch the burger.
Mm.
You put it on the grill. You grill one side. You flip it. You do not touch it. You do not push it around. You do not, as one cretin I saw, whack the back of the burger with the spatula to get the fat out.
Yeah,
because not only are you compressing the burger, the fat is what makes it taste good.
Right. I mean, people need to understand that fat, when heated, becomes juice.
Exactly. It's juicy. Oh, it's so juicy.
Right.
Fat tastes good.
Exactly. And you should not be packing it down with your hands when you're making it.
You make it as loosely as you can to hold together.
That's right. Right. And I'm with you on the thickness as well. I think that you want the stratification.
Right.
You want multiple layers of texture.
Yeah.
And if a burger's too thin, you can't develop those different layers.
Right. And if it's too thick, then the outside will char before the inside cooks.
Right. What dish do you wish you could cook?
Oh, gosh. There are a lot of dishes I wish I could cook. But I really wish I could make a good pie crust. I've tried. My pie crusts have not succeeded. But if I could make a good pie crust, I would be a happy man.
Have you tried using lard?
I've tried using just about everything. I've tried to use shortening. I've tried to use butter. I even tried the vodka method. Do you know about this?
No.
Oh, this was come up with, as you know, if you've ever made a pie crust, the problem is liquid. If you put in too much water, it becomes soggy and dense, and it's way too chewy and does not have that sort of wonderful flaky thing you want from a good pie crust. If you don't put in enough water, you then have a very dry dough that you can't
roll
out. It crumbles. It doesn't roll out. Right. It doesn't cut. Okay. The guys at America's Test Kitchen came up with this brilliant idea. You use vodka because the vodka provides liquid, but since vodka is almost all alcohol, that will bake away.
Right.
So it'll basically evaporate away. And you'll end up with the crust. So in other words, you can work the crust because it's moist, but then the vodka, the alcohol will evaporate away in the cooking and it'll end up flaky and light. And it works okay.
I'm a proponent of lard in crust.
Right.
Robert Smith from NPR did a great piece on Planet Money a while back called Who Killed Lard? And it was all about the concerted effort by Crisco and with some help from Upton Sinclair, all about how there was a kind of campaign against lard that vilified it and made it seem disgusting and unsanitary. But in reality, it's not any worse for you than butter or other animal fats.
I'm about to drop a name, so hold out your hands.
I'm ready.
My friend Rick Bayless, who runs this vast empire of superb Mexican cuisine here in Chicago.
Yeah.
He is a huge proponent of lard.
What is one food that is not improved by the addition of either melted cheese or chocolate syrup?
That's a good question. I actually don't add melted cheese to anything. And the reason I don't is because of Courtney Love.
Naturally. Question. All right, moving on.
I don't know the rules here. Can one swear on this podcast?
Well, I can bleep it if it's going to totally mess
up
your story.
Well, basically, yeah, I kind of will. So this is
to do it.
This is something that I found in of all places, Harper's, in that thing in the front. And it was an interview with Courtney Love. And she was talking, and I will swear because Courtney Love swears and you will bleep it. And Courtney Love was swearing because she said, oh, in high school was awful. I was so fat, no one would me. It was terrible. I had to lose all this weight because before anyone would me. Oh, really? Well, how'd you lose the weight? And she says, it's all the fucking cheese. They melt cheese over fucking everything. It's like, if you want to have cheese, just have a nice piece of cheese, but don't like fucking melt it on everything. And that changed my life. Thank you, Courtney, if you're listening. Because it's true. In America, they melt cheese on everything to cover it, to add fat and add, sort of this wonderful greasy mouthfeel. And if you just stop eating cheese melted on everything, then A, you taste what you're eating because it's not covered in milk fat, and B, you actually lose some weight because there's a lot of calories in that cheese. I love a piece of cheese, but I try not to melt it on stuff for the Courtney Love reason.
But so wait, let me understand. Do you not agree that putting calories aside momentarily, let's assume you just ran 20 miles.
Yes.
Do you not agree that melted cheese improves most of the things it touches?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you had a – but I think that the fact that melted cheese improves things is more of a condemnation of whatever it's improving. If you get a good piece of bread, you don't need to melt cheese on it. Not that melting cheese on it isn't very good.
What alcoholic beverage did you drink too much of as a teenager, thus rendering the beverage undrinkable for you for the rest of your life?
It wasn't as a teenager. It was as a very recent college graduate, and it was ouzo. I ended up in Greece the summer after I graduated and drank a lot of ouzo and had one in particular, really unpleasant night, and I cannot get near this stuff this day.
Ouzo is
sort of the national Greek liqueur, and it's anise flavored, it's licorice flavored,
so it's
not as if it's a huge sacrifice.
Right.
But
that's the kind of thing, I feel like it wouldn't take a whole lot of ouzo.
No, it wouldn't take a whole lot of ouzo, but man, whatever that number was, I got there. And
what is a food that you loved as a child that you hate now?
Oh, man. That is a good question. A food that I loved as a kid but hated now. I used to really love big piles of spaghetti and meatballs.
Mm.
That was probably my favorite meal as a kid. And I'm perfectly happy to eat a plate of spaghetti and meatballs, but it's far from my favorite.
Yeah. What was your technique and what is your technique today for getting the spaghetti on the fork? Do you go more of a horizontal sweep across the top or do you go perpendicular to the plate straight down and twirl?
I'm a twirler.
Okay.
I'm a twirler when it comes to your spaghetti.
I do not.
I've always wanted to be one of those guys who twirls it against the spoon because it always seemed very artful.
Right.
But I never manage that. And I'm too impatient to reach down and get the spoon. I'm just grabbing a bite. But definitely the bottom of the plate, twirl, twirl, twirl. Eat.
If you end up with too much spaghetti on the end of the fork, if you twirl it and you end up, it gets all caught up in it with a big ball of spaghetti, how do you deal with that?
I just go for it, which causes my 15-year-old daughter, aforementioned, quite a lot of distress. Could you just take smaller bites? She yells.
Yeah, but have you ever gone in, like, sometimes it'll still be dangling off the ball of spaghetti.
That's a bad problem, yeah.
And sometimes you have to abort and you just dump it back on the plate.
Yeah, that's bad.
That's bad.
You know what? I wish I lived in one of those cultures where rudeness, noises, slurping noises, like Japan, they say that, right? Slurping noises indicates how much you're enjoying it. I wish I lived in one of those cultures because I eat pretty much like a sow.
Yeah, me too. Like the two of us would be the most polite guys in town.
I know. I'm going to invite those guys over. You wouldn't believe the noises they make when they're eating. They fart and they burp. They're great. I can't believe how gracious they are. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love those guys.
All right, I'm buying.
They were raised well.
I'm buying us some plane tickets right now.
Let's go, baby.
Let's get out of here. What is a food that you hated as a child that you love now?
Oh man, I was not a particularly picky eater, but I'm trying to remember if things I hated. Tomatoes, probably.
Mm.
I remember I really didn't like tomatoes. I didn't like their texture. And I remember watching on Sesame Street, and for some reason, after the end of a sequence of some events, it was like letter T for tomato, and like things that started with T. And the last shot was this girl picking up a tomato and taking a bite out of it. And I remember reacting like, ah! Like she had just eaten the head off a live animal. How gross.
Right.
And I could never imagine doing that. And now there's nothing I like more. Slicing open a fresh tomato and slicing it up, putting a little salt on it.
Yeah. I have the same answer. I could only eat like tomato sauce and ketchup as a kid. I couldn't have even sliced tomato on my sandwiches for a long time. And I finally have just gotten into it. I think a big part of the problem is that I feel like of all the seasonal foods, tomatoes are the most important food to eat in season and only in season.
Right.
And just be grateful that you have them for the month or two that you have them when they're amazingly delicious. And the rest of the year, just don't eat them.
Or get them canned, which is better than those weird plastic things they say.
Right. Final question.
Yes.
If heaven exists,
yes.
What would you like to see on the menu? Keeping in mind that in heaven you can eat as much as you want without getting fat.
Is it a restaurant or is it like cuz
it's one meal. What would you order from the menu?
Oh man.
This is your one meal.
Can I give a slightly different answer, which is that there's a couple of adjoining squares in Portland, Oregon that have about in total about 30 food trucks. And to me heaven is like that. To me heaven is like whatever, man. We got the taco truck over here. We got the Thai food truck over here. We got the barbecue truck over here. Welcome. Except it doesn't rain. If Portland didn't rain,
it would be heaven. What's your food truck strategy?
Part of the is you had infinite time to enjoy all the food trucks. I'm one of those guys who sadly is always thinking there's something that I don't know. So I'm always thinking that this is my nightmare. Is like you go to one of these squares and say, "Oh, I went to the sandwich truck," and then you get back and you tell them, "You went to the sandwich truck when it was right next to the Stromboli truck. You didn't get a everybody gets the Stromboli. You didn't know."
Well, Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, playwright, author, man of words and letters.
Yes,
thank you so much.
My pleasure, Dan. It was fun.
So thanks again to Peter Sagal. As expected, he was smart, funny, and gracious. Although I must say, I should have challenged him a little more on his statements regarding melted cheese. I mean, I will grant him that there are a few instances where the fact that a subpar food is improved by melted cheese is an indication of that food's inadequacy. But with all due respect, I believe those instances are less common than Peter suggests. And there are many more times when a very good food joins together with melted cheese to create something even greater than the sum of its parts. And if you don't believe me, ask 11-year-old Maggie, our caller from the top of the show. Remember what she said?
I have a big problem with people masking the cheese.
Exactly. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.